session number 22675 at Reel 3.
Crowd in Reel 3.
So the troop moved back to their headquarters, which was next to a police station, and we believe somebody must have leaked the incident because it was very amusing to everyone on our side, and the police were informed, and of course we had to pay for the damage which came out of commando funds. And I believe one or two people were put on a charge over it, but I'm not sure about that. Then moved back to the mainland and were entrained for Liverpool. Now remember when we went to Madagascar, we went out of Greenock back to Liverpool. This time we were going out of the UK from Liverpool, and believe it or not, we came back to Greenock. So we were saying we knew not where, with Far Eastern equipment, and boarded this ship and sailed out of Liverpool Harbour. Wonderful sight, the buildings there, the Liver building. Sailed out and once again joined a massive convoy. This time we didn't go across the Atlantic, we went through the Med and stopped at Gibraltar again and were allowed a day there. When we sailed out of Gibraltar, all the lights were on the North African coast, which was a heck of a sight. It was, of course, I'll think of it later. It was, of course, the country of... I'll think of it later. But it's a marvellous sight, the only lights we ever saw. When we were then in a commando brigade, there were four different commandos, number one and number five army commandos, and we by then wearing our green berets, and two Royal Marine commandos. Their battalions had been moved in, and they were sent up to Scotland for the commando training, and then qualified to wear green berets. And nearly every brigade, there was two brigades in Europe, one in the Far East, which was going to be us, and one in the Middle East, one brigade. Nearly three of those brigades had two army commandos and two Royal Marine commandos, but in one there was three army commandos, I believe, and one Royal Marine commando. So we were split up into two ships, the commandos. On one was number one commando, number one army commando, and number 42 Royal Marine commando. And on the other ship, which I was on, was number five army commando and number 44 Royal Marine commando. When we got off Crete, we were attacked by the Luftwaffe. We were lucky, we weren't hit. The only trouble was you weren't allowed on deck to watch it. You had to stay down below and listen to the clumps. And only the gunners were on deck. And unfortunately, the other ship with the commandos on it was hit, not badly hit, but badly. Only one man was killed, and he was in the toilet, hit by a piece of the ship, I think. And they had to sail into North Africa so the ship could be repaired, and we didn't see them for about 2.5 months. Anyway, we were now on the way to India, and 2 days out of India, we used to train on board ship and have leisure. But 2 days out of India, two Japanese turned up on deck. We couldn't believe it, because obviously they were the people we were going to fight. And they turned out to be two former Japanese who were now American, naturalized Americans. And they were there to teach us Japanese phrases. They taught us six phrases, and the only one I can remember is because, in my opinion, it was ridiculous. And the phrase in Japanese was Teo Ange. And what it meant in English was, hands up. Now, it's pointless asking the chap to put his hands up, because they wouldn't, they just kept coming at you. So we landed in Bombay, and then, I didn't see much of Bombay, and a little bit we drove through. And we ended up a few miles away on a very large plane called Keg Garn, where we were billeted in tents, and it was very, very hot. Every evening we'd march out about half a mile to showers, cold showers, and by the time we marched back we were sweating again. And we used to do exercise there, and one exercise a sergeant lost his Tommy gun crossing some water. I was used to swimming underwater, and I eventually found the damn thing underneath the water, of course, and it was ruined. But he was put on the charge for losing his Tommy gun, and of course it was replaced. And we went out on other exercises. At nights we used to hear a piper playing a tune on a hill, which was quite nice. We would get the occasional whirlwind coming towards us, and we would pray it wouldn't hit our tent, but it always hit a tent, and it would take it up in the air, and all the contents were scattered all over the place. If it didn't hit your tent, it was highly amusing, and you enjoyed it. I had one leave from there, that was in Pune, and I was a pretty poor tennis player, but I was due to play tennis with the medical sergeant. We always had our own doctor, our own padre as well. The doctor had about four orderlies with him, and they went into action. But when you went into serious action, you had a senior medical team with you, surgeons, and they did marvellous work. And we went into Bangalore, and Pune, I beg your pardon, and had a super leave, but I had to play him tennis most days, and he was about as bad as I was, and we used to play right through the midday sun, which wasn't very good. Anyway, it's now time for action, and we joined a ship in Bombay, and were taken beyond Calcutta to a small harbour. And it, of course, only half the brigade was there, and it was number 5 Army and number 44 Royal Marine Commando, and we did quite a lot together. In this case, we were shipped down the coast from the small harbour, which was named Chittagong, and then we landed, and we then marched to a village called, well, at the edge of a village called Alathangu, where there were already trenches, which people had moved out of when the 14th Army were retreating from the Yaps. And we occupied this place. We hadn't been there long. In fact, some chaps were down on the beach to get supplies for us. The Burmese natives in the village had brought us in slices of melon, which was absolute luxury. And when in Burma, you always dug in a square. In other words, a square box, because you never knew which way the Japs were coming, and whichever way they came, you'd be ready for them. I got my mess tin and went into the bushes to make myself some tea. Then the Japs started opening up with their long-range guns from the hills, and I ran for my life to my trench. When the firing stopped, I went back to get my mess tin, which was then full of dirt, and ruined my tea. Unfortunately, the section who went down to the beach, a shell landed right amongst them. Most of them were killed, and a very good friend of mine, a Scotsman named Dalgleish, she was badly wounded, but the Navy managed to pull him off. We had a very young Welshman there, a brilliant scholar, who was killed, and it was difficult to bury him because his body was absolutely shattered, but they buried him just the top of the beach. But my wounded friend was taken off, and he had severe wounds. He was taken out to a hospital ship, which was always hovering nearby when we were in action. We stayed there 10 days, and we got a bit of a bashing. The guns were getting on our nerves, and decided to send a patrol out early one evening, and they went out, it was getting dark. Luckily, I wasn't on it. And as they were marching out, the Japs were coming to attack us in three sides of a box, and they walked into the open end, and a hell of a fight ensued, and one chap was out there all night wounded, but we weren't allowed out to rescue him. He was wounded 7 times, but managed to live, and lived for a number of years. The next morning, I saw an order coming round the box from the commanding officer, and believe it or not, it ended with me. And the order was to go out to where this battle had taken, just outside the box, bring the wounded in and the dead. And when I got there, I'd never seen anything like it, of course. I'd never seen a dead person, not even in Madagascar. And by then, the bodies were getting cold and quite grotesque, because some of the limbs had stiffened and the arms were pointing heavenward. And I did my best to break them before I asked the chaps to carry them in. My rank was then a Lance Sergeant, so I had a bit of authority. And so we took the bodies in, buried, somebody else buried the dead, and the wounded were tended to, and then got out to sea onto the hospital ship.
What was the name of this place?
Alathangu, the village. It was Alethangaw. And it was one of the four landings we did in Burma. And we were in trouble because these guns were giving us hell. And so we decided to call in the RAF for help. But unlike Europe, you couldn't get almost immediate help. We had to wait for the next day. When two planes came in, I'd never seen them before. They were the Volte Vengeance dive bombers. They were American planes. And they carried a crew of two. And the poor rear gunner sat behind the pilot, but he was facing to the rear. So when they were dive bombing, he was looking up at the sky. And when our people first dive bombed, a lot of them didn't pull out of it when they were doing it for the first time. But these two did, and as they dive bombed, we took the opportunity to get out. Unfortunately for me, my troop only got 2 miles out when we were told that we had to take up a defensive position to make sure the rest of the commando got clear. We dug in, a villager came along, and we asked him in our broken Burmese if he'd seen any Japanese. He informed us that there were 60 heading our way with swords. Japanese army officers carry swords, and warrant officers carry swords. So we dug in and waited. In the early hours of the morning, we heard the bush swishing about, and we stood to, we were standing to almost all night. Luckily for us, it turned out to be cattle and not Japanese, and luckily we didn't shoot any, otherwise they'd have heard the sound of firing. So we moved out the next morning. By that time the rest of the commando got away, except one troop, and we were stopped by an amphibious vehicle, a duck, with two army officers on board, and they informed our troop leader, which would be the rank of captain, and he had two second lieutenants with him, that some of our artillery had been cut off by the Japanese. They'd stormed up the hill and captured them. And would we rescue them? Not only that, one of our troops had gone in to rescue them, number five troop, and they were all pinned to the ground. Some of those were killed and injured. So we went in, and my lieutenant was Lieutenant Noble. And he asked me with my section to form a bridgehead, which he went through, and be there when they came out. He was an extremely brave man and got an immediate VC, which didn't happen very often. And the reason was that he rescued three of our wounded and got some of those cut off, including the artillery. And they came out through me, and I spoke to him, and he couldn't speak. He was so het up with the excitement, or he was dumb. Anyway, they came out, and we all moved out together. Got some of our own fire troop out. Two of our chaps were killed. One of another very good friend of mine, a chap named Jones, who was engaged to a girl in England, and he was shot in both legs. And unfortunately, when it was time to move out, he raised his body to get help to get him out. And as he raised his body, he was shot again and killed. And no, he wasn't killed. He was badly wounded. And he was eventually taken to hospital, and he didn't want to live because he was so badly wounded, and so he died. And was one of the quite few commandos who were buried out there, later moved to military cemeteries. So we got out of that one, and soon after that, the rest of the brigade, who were held up in North Africa, joined us. And at that time, the Japs were pushing through into northern India. They didn't actually get in, but there were two battles up there, one at Kohima and one quite near to Kohima. And it was decided one of the reasons we were pulled out of action was that we should fly up there and help them out. By the time we got out, the monsoons had started, and in those days, planes couldn't fly in the monsoon. So my particular... Yes, the whole commando went up there by train, and as we were going up, coming back on the other line, wounded, trains full of wounded. And we would stop at a station where film army kitchens were ready to feed us. By the time we got up there, we were too late to go into action, and we stayed at a place called Silchar, and where there was a large tea plantation, where the ladies of the plantation would bring us chocolate cake once a week, which was very nice. We were under canvas, the monsoon had just ended, rivers had risen about 12 feet, cattle were floating down, dead cattle. And then we were told that an African battalion there were on the point of mutiny because they'd been out there prior to the war and they should have gone home earlier on, but they weren't being allowed home because of the war. They were on the point of mutiny. So one morning my troop had to get in a truck, fully armed, and go to a parade ground where these people were going to be brought on parade and read the riot act. We didn't like the idea of it, but we went round there, were concealed behind this parade ground. They were brought out on parade and warned and told that they would be going home possibly within 6 months. So there, thank goodness there was no riot. Now, that was a place called Sylhet, which was close to Silchar, and there was an airport there. And there were lots of Dakota aircraft flown by American pilots, American crews, and they were flying food and ammunition into where these two battles had been. So I went round there and asked them if I could come for a ride. And they said that I'd have to get permission from my commanding officer and hand it to the Royal Army Service Corps colonel, who was in charge of the whole operation to get the stores up there. So I nipped back to my camp and saw my troop officer, who in fact gave me a chitty, and I went back, and this pilot agreed to take me. There were no seats in it, of course, apart from the crew. It was full of supplies. And on the way up to this place, if they ever saw any of the natives in a boat, they would dive down just over the boat, and these poor natives were jumping in the water in the hope that it would save them. They never hit any of them, of course. And we landed them, and I helped unload. And before we got on board to fly back to Sylhet, the pilot said to me, "Will you come back again tomorrow and bring a box of grenades, and we can fly into the hills and drop these grenades?" And I said, "Yes, of course." Had no intention of doing it, of course. And eventually made my way back to the camp. But it was quite a thing. I'm still trying to think of the name of the other place where a bigger battle took place.
Imphal.
Imphal. Which, of course, the 14th Army won. Went back to the camp, and then I was told I had to take a patrol into the Naga Hills. It was then owned by India, Nagaland it's now called, and it's now got its independence, in case the Japs came around that way. Well, there are only five of us. How they expected us to stop them? We might delay them. How we expect them to get back to warn the rest of them, I don't know. But I was told to do that, and didn't even have a wireless set. So on the way, we had to pass through an elephant camp, and these elephants were used for moving logs to set up defences. And this was something the Japanese did. They made these big dugouts, and on top were these logs, and they were very secure positions. But later, when we went into action for our big battle out there, we had a few tanks with us. And the tactics of the tanks was if they saw one of these places, they'd go on top of it and wriggle it and fill it in with the Japs inside. Anyway, I took this patrol out into Nagaland, found a village, and the Nagas were influenced by a lady, somebody from Surrey, who lived there quite a lot, and converted them to Christianity. And then I saw this lovely little hill with about six huts on it, two quite large. One was a Christian church, and the big one was where most of the natives lived, and they had a fire inside with no chimney. And during our stay there, fortunately, no Japs appeared, and we used to go in the church and pray, and we stayed there for 5 days. We had to stay a day longer, and ran out of food. So I took three chaps down into the jungle. There wasn't a lot of jungle there. And we shot two monkeys, a male and a female, one black, one golden brown, and took them back. And the natives carved them up and cooked them over this fire with no chimney, and it ended up like pieces of black leather. One chap refused to eat it, but the rest of us were so hungry, we ate this monkey, and it was awful. Excuse me. It was then time to leave. So I took them out, and to my horror, found myself the wrong side of a river before we hit this small town, which was about a mile from where the commando were camped. And luckily I saw, I don't know whether he's Indian or Burmese, I think he was an Indian gentleman, on the other side of a river with a large black umbrella, which they use either to keep the sun off or to keep the monsoon off. And I hailed him, swam across, stripped off, and said, could he help us? Luckily he spoke a bit of English. Could he help us ferry the equipment across in his umbrella, inverted umbrella, which he agreed to do. And we eventually got across, kept our weapons dry, and when we got over there, he invited us to a meal, which was curried chicken, and it's the best meal I've ever had in my life, because I'm not fond of curry now, but we were so damned hungry. And foolishly, I didn't take his name and address, you know, because I should have written to him and reimbursed him in a small way. Anyway, we got back to the commando, and it was then that I found, oh, by the way, I'd acquired a minor bird by there, and somebody built a cage for me, and I tried to make it talk, but it was never successful. Anyway, I was then told that I was on the advance party to Ceylon. Got a train at Silchar with one officer and about 12 men. Spent a whole week in this train getting down to the point where you cross by boat to Ceylon, and sat on the steps of this train and watched India go by for a whole week, sometimes over these very shaky looking bridges, and watched India go by, and it was quite good. Stopped at certain stations for meals, and took us a whole week, and when we arrived in Ceylon, the camp was wonderful. It was in Trincomalee, it was in a coconut grove, on the edge of the beach, where I took an early opportunity to have a swim before we got the camp ready, and was stung by a jellyfish, which was very, very painful. Never had another swim, and waited for the commando to arrive. Can I take a break there? One evening we went out for a walk and came across a naval bar, because in Trincomalee it's a naval place, and it must have been 100 feet long. And we had an enjoyable evening there, and we actually saw some wrens, but the wrens were the new untouchables. And we were in Trincomalee to regroup, and the whole brigade eventually moved in, and we boarded the ships, and we were heading for the Arakan coast of Burma. We were to do three landings there, and the first one was Akiab, which is an enormous island just off of the coast of Burma, the Arakan coast. And when we landed, the Japs had gone. And we had quite an enjoyable 3 days there. We slept rough, of course. The second day, the Japanese Air Force turned up. But they weren't there for long, because the Royal Air Force came out of the sun and either shot them all down, or those that weren't shot down were dispersed. And that was the last time we saw the Japanese Air Force, thank goodness, unlike the Pacific. So we stayed there a few days. There were wrecked bridges, a bit of a mess, but we had no fighting to do there. We found a whole place which was really a paddy field, quite a large paddy field, with damaged Japanese planes. They would never fly again, but I imagine they stored them there for spares, and so there was nothing we could do there. So we went down the coast again, and the with the support of the Indian Navy as well. And before these landings, the Navy and Air Force would absolutely batter the landing beaches. And the whole place, when they did this, you would see the whole place vibrating. It was wonderful. Funnily enough, though, one or two Japs always survived. So our next landing was at a place called Maibon. And we landed and quickly got into trouble. Moved inland a little way, and of course there are always mines on the beaches, and on this second beach, the Royal Navy Beachmaster was killed by a shell from the Japanese. We moved inland, but we couldn't get very far, and we had to call for help from the RAF. Once again, they couldn't come that day. We had to wait till the next day. But the next day, they put in some very effective bombing, and we were able to probe forward. I found a trench with three Japanese dead in it, shoulder to shoulder, and they appeared to be alive. And we got one or two souvenirs. They all carried photographs, of course, of their families. And we got a couple of revolvers, a rifle, a Japanese flag, which I enjoyed getting. And then we moved forward again and got on landing craft, believe it or not, to go to our next destination, which was up a Chong. A Chong is a river, which was approximately 12 miles inland. But there was a beach there, and because the sea went right up this Chong, and we landed there and moved on to a hill, which was codenamed Brighton, but we never called it Brighton. It was Hill 170, because it was 170 feet in height. Quite a long hill, really, where we had to dig in. Now, the reason we were there was the 14th Army were chasing the Japs down Burma, and we were going to straddle their easiest escape route and let other troops in to form a massive bridgehead. We dug in that same night, and it was very hard. It was like the beach at Brighton, very stony, but the priority was to dig in, and luckily we weren't shelled as we were digging in. We were quite soon afterwards, and my commander, number five, were not up the sharp end where the Japs were coming from. And we dug in, and once again, I went down the hill to make tea, one side of the hill, not the bad side, and got some water out of a bomb hole. Found a native lady and a child who had been killed in the bombing, and arranged for somebody to remove them. Got the water out of the bomb hole, took it back, and we had little blocks of fuel which you lit, and that would heat up the mess tin underneath. And so heating the water up, put the tea in, went to drink it, and found it was salt water. That's how tired it was. I could have cried. So I emptied that and used the water out of my water bottle, which was quite precious. And with the water bottle, you had to put in a tablet every time you filled it. Otherwise, it might not be safe to drink. And you had to take a further tablet called Mepocrine, which was to offset malaria. There were two types of malaria you could catch. One you would just have once, and one you would have perhaps twice a year. I faithfully took my Mepocrine tablet every evening, always without fail. Before that, we had quinine, which was awful to take. That was in Madagascar, where we always used to buy some nut toffee, plenty of nut toffee because of the fields of monkey nuts. And you would have to go on parade, and the sergeant and officer would come round, made sure you drank a spoonful, and then you would thrust a bit of nut toffee in your mouth to take the taste away. So there we were, safely ensconced down our hill with our American K rations, which we were using for the first time, and soon got fed up with it because they were too rich, and eventually we preferred to go back to bully beef and hard biscuits. And we used to get extra things. Occasionally we'd get a tin of fruit, but my section officer was very fond of tinned fruit, and if there was one over, we didn't get it, he had it. So we dug in, and then soon after that, the shelling started. And what turned out to be a normal landing after a skirmish to begin with turned out to be one of the fiercest, if not the fiercest, battle in Burma, because the Japs, we were in the Japs' way. And eventually they attacked the hill, got a foothold on it. A member of one commando, an officer who'd only been with us 3 weeks, got the VC posthumously. And only a month ago, I went to the school he went to as a boy, where we presented him the plaque, which went in the school hall. Countess Mountbatten was there, and 450 pupils were there. Only two of them white. Marvellous school, headmistress, perfect woman. They piped us in front of the school. Countess Mountbatten unveiled the memorial. It was really a memorable day.
What school was this?
I'll have to look that up, I'm afraid. And it was in Croydon. And it really was a memorable day. And
can you describe the fighting you were in on this?
Yes, hill? Yeah. The fighting was very grim. We suffered lots of casualties. Every commando, three commandos had 30 killed, and the odd commando, which was 42, had about 20 killed, but there were lots of